I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and equanimity. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents, ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Dhanamanda Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samvayana. Welcome to the teaching on the Sakya treasures. Lama Jampa asked me to teach on the biography of Sakyapandita, but in order to understand the biography of Sakyapandita, we need to know who were some of the people around him. And so we'll take a look at just very briefly take a look at some of the major figures in the Sakya school. Previously, we had some classes about how the Sakya lineage and the Kun family lineage arrived historically from prehistoric times, from outer space, basically. And so now we're going to backtrack a little bit and go back to the first founder, what's called the five founders of the Sakya school, Sachin Khunga Ningpo, born in 1093. The Sakya school has what they call the five founders, and there is a tanka here where they are exhibited with Sachin Khunga Ningpo in the middle, the central figure. They're related, but there's some interesting deviations in the lineage. So Sachin Khunga Ningpo, he had four sons. Mm-hmm. Sonam Semo, Drapa Gyaltsen, Palchen Upo, and Khungabat. Interestingly, only two of the sons are amongst the five founders. That doesn't mean the other two sons were not worth anything, and in fact, they were Manjushri Buddha emanations. They just didn't fill the role of founder, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about why and who did what, but they are included in what are called the seven emanations of Manjushri. I'll explain that in a minute. Palchen Upo had a son who was Sakyapandita. He was born in 1182. And then Sakyapandita had a nephew, Drogon Chogyapakpa, who was the fifth founder. He was born in 1235. Those are the five founders of Sakya, and you'll hear about them and see them depicted. Now, the seven Manjushris, you may or may not be familiar with the story of Atisha, the great saint Atisha. When Atisha went from India to Tibet, he was sent there by Tara. Tara talked to him at Bodh Gaya and said, go to Tibet. He said, I'm old, and I only have this thin Indian cotton cloth. And she said, don't worry, I'll take care of you, I'll give you a coat. And so he took off at an old age to Tibet, and this was in the 800s, I think. And in those days, there was no sakya. There was no town or temple or lineage or anything. It was just a bare hill, the famous white hill of Sakya, which is what Sakya means, white hill. Atisha had his attendants with him, and when they passed the white hill of Sakya, Atisha stopped and he started doing prostrations to the hill. And the attendants are all like, what's he doing? Has the old man gone crazy or what? You know, and so they said, what are you doing? They said, well, don't you see it? And they said, no, see what? And he said, well, there's seven D's, D-H-I, the letter D, seven D's, one Hri, and one Hung. And they said, okay, what does that mean? He said, that means there's going to be seven Manjushri emanations, one Chinrezi emanation, and one Vajrapani emanation. The seven Manjushris include the two brothers who are not part of the five founder group. So they weren't slacking off, they were doing other things. And Kunga Bhatt actually went to India to study and ended up passing away at a fairly young age, which a lot of these historical figures did. They did pass away at a relatively young age. Now we have to remember, we're talking about 1,000 years ago, and the lifespan then wasn't like it is here where we are in the West, where it's not unusual to live to be 80 or even more, whereas back then, people, generally speaking, didn't live that long. There were exceptions, of course, but, for example, Sonam Semo, he only lived to be 40. These figures did more in 40 years than we do in lifetimes, you know, and Sonam Semo was so advanced that when he passed away, he didn't even leave his body, he just left. And so Kunga Bhatt didn't live that long, but Palchen Upo, he did live a little bit longer, and also Drapa Gyaltsen lived longer. Drapa Gyaltsen is another very famous historical figure. I think he's interesting because, first of all, he was a lay person, and he was a vegetarian in Tibet 1,000 years ago, and there weren't that many, I don't think. There's a lot of stories about him. We won't go into him tonight. There's some very interesting history about him. And Sakya Pandita, who was his nephew, Drapa Gyaltsen was the guru of Sakya Pandita. Sakya Pandita being the grandson of Sachin Kunga Lingpo. So I hope that's clear. But that's why I drew it out on a chart here for you. That just gives you the lay of the land as to between, say, 1093 and 1280. But we're going to go into more detail of all of this, of course. When Lama asked me to teach the biography of Sakya Pandita, I think you can see the importance of Sakya Pandita just by seeing the size of the statue here. It's way bigger than any statue here. And also this Sakya Pandita doing debate. He was very famous for debate. We'll talk about some debating stories. Lama doesn't like that Tanka because he's wearing very nice clothes in the Tanka. And Lama said, he didn't dress like that. He wore patched clothes. He looked like a beggar. People thought he was just, you know, a really poor beggar. And because, of course, they didn't care about brocades and stuff, but anyway, he looks really nice there.
Tanka is a work of art.
There's a history behind that Tanka. It was commissioned for this Dharma Center by a British monk who passed away in a plane crash going over the Himalayas.
Oh.
And before, he was young too, and before he died, he commissioned that. That's a very, very expensive Tanka. He commissioned it.
I know, it's just like...
And gave it to Geshe-la, the founder. And there's some other interesting figures in that Tanka. So you can see that Sakya Pandita, he's also in here, of course, in that Tanka. Now this large statue Sakya Pandita, that was bequeathed by our founder, Geshe Tashi Namgyal. It was in his will. And that was fashioned in Kathmandu for this center and shipped over here. It's full of mantras and holy objects and relics and all kinds of things. Sakya Pandita, now you notice in the, this tanka, he has a hat on. But when the statue arrived, there was a hat with it. But Lama Jampa said, well, if you take the hat off, we can see his Ushnisha, his top knot, which is one of the signs that Sakya Pandita had as a Buddha. We'll talk about that too, the signs of a Buddha that showed he was actually a Buddha. And so Lama Jampa took the hat off. I don't know where it ended up. But anyway. And if you notice, there's a diamond. It's not really a diamond, but a third eye. There's a, like, it looks like a diamond. Lama Jampa had that put on. Because one of the signs of a Buddha is you have a curled, like, hair right out where your third eye is. It goes counterclockwise. That's one of the signs. The statue didn't have that, so Lama Jampa stuck a diamond on there. He did some modifications. So we're going to focus on Sakya Pandita in this talk.
I just have a quick question.
Okay.
So Sakya Pandita is a Buddha?
He was Manjushri Buddha. He was one of the seven Manjushris, a wisdom Buddha, Buddha of wisdom. You might ask the question, well, why bother? Why bother study biography of somebody? I mean, it's kind of interesting, but is that the only reason to study it? To that question, Chogyal Pakpa, the fifth founder, answered that question by saying, quote, the biographies of previous lamas, such as Sachin Khunga Ningpo and others, including myself, tell how they dedicated their lives to the Dharma. And it's important for you to make a commitment to follow those biographies. So it isn't just, you know, tell a nice story, but this is to influence our own practice and give us some inspiration. This book about biographies of Sakya Pandita was just published just literally weeks ago. There are three biographies in this collection, and the three biographies that were chosen, because there's many, over 1,000 years, there's been a lot of them. The 44 Sakya Treason chose these three because he thought they would be good ones. But he also wrote a pretty long introduction in which he told some of the stories that are also in these other biographies. So some of these stories are repeated, different biographies and from a different angle, you know. But one of the things that the 41st Sakya Treason said about these biographies, he answered the same question, well, why should we bother studying these biographies? And he said, well, of course, it's a source of inspiration. But also, we can learn how these earlier gurus proceeded. We can learn how they studied. We can learn how they practiced. Because the Sakya school really emphasizes study. Practice, too, for sure. But there's a lot of emphasis on learning and the colleges and the philosophy and so on. Sakya Treason said, you can see how these great gurus studied and practiced. And you can see how that helped them to develop their own experience. You know, it wasn't just something they read in a book or somebody told them, but okay, they read it in a book maybe, but then they went and they practiced it and had the experience. And there's stories about how certain practices and sadhanas were actually tweaked, were edited, so to speak, because these gurus had meditative experiences. And maybe they saw another line in the mantra or a symbol. And so the sadhanas were adjusted. So their experience as masters was validated by the school. And Sakya Treason said, by doing all this, you can see how did they actually attain realization. Okay? And then what do? We try to follow them. And then he said at the end, Sakya Treason said, that for him personally, these biographies really have inspired him in his journey in his practice and so on and so forth. And I was just talking earlier with Lama about the 41st Sakyatrizin, who is still alive today, but in the future when historians write the history of Sakya, he will be a giant figure. First of all, he's been the longest reigning Sakyatrizin, more than 50 years. He's the father of the 42nd and the 43rd. The Sakyatrizin said that he personally was inspired by biographies, and he's a historical figure of grand proportions. Not only is he the longest serving Sakyatrizin, but he was the person that escaped from Tibet with literally nothing but, you know, the shirt on his back, and reestablished in India, got everything going again, started Sakya College, International Buddhist Academy, started traveling around the world and teaching, and now Sakya School, which was small before, is literally worldwide. Australia, South America, Mexico, all over Europe, North America, you know, not to mention India and Nepal and those places. He's a grand, grand figure and a great guru and a Buddha.
And this one here in the picture.
I've never heard him make one single mistake in his English. Native speakers make mistakes. No, it's very incredible. And also his sons.
Is he still alive?
Yeah. He's 80.
Oh, my.
He's still active, too. Yeah. Uh-huh. And not only that, but his sons now, they all speak Mandarin Chinese, too. The sons and the Dungses, up-and-coming Kun family members, speak 8 or 9 languages. Yeah. I mean, they're all Manjushris, so they have the wisdom. I'm not saying it's easy for them, but I think it's a little easier. So. Anyway, it's extraordinary. It's really, yeah. Okay, so that's the introduction about why we're going to do this. Okay. Who was Sakya Pandita? Well, first of all, he wasn't born Sakya Pandita. I've been told by Tibetans that it's not unusual for them not to really pay much attention to when babies are born, when their birthday was, or what to name them. They might name them according to the day of the week. So there's lots of Wednesdays running around. And,
yeah. Yeah.
And so they don't get named right away. But Sakya Pandita was close to his uncle, Drapa Gyaltsen. And when Sakya Pandita was a young age, Drapa Gyaltsen named him Kunga Gyaltsen. And that's actually his name, Kunga Gyaltsen. Although he's usually referred to as Sakya Pandita. Later on, when he was ordained a monk, the abbot of the monastery where the ordination took place tacked on a third name, which was Palsangbo. Sometimes you'll see Kunga Gyaltsen Palsangbo, but that's kind of long. You don't always see it, but Sakya Pandita had those names. I'm not going to go into this in too much detail, but Pandita is a title which indicates that the person has mastered the 5 major and the 5 minor sciences of India. It comes from India. Before Sakya Pandita, there were no Panditas in Tibet. He was the first. We'll talk at some length later about what are these major and minor sciences, what did he study, what did he master, what did he write about, what did he do with it, what did he teach. But just for now, we'll just leave it at that Pandita is his title. Palchen Upo was his father, and then when his mother was pregnant with, actually before she got pregnant, she had a dream, and in the dream, a Naga king came to her. Nagas are these kind of interesting beings that, technically speaking, fall under the animal realm, but they're very unusual because they have, some of them anyway, have this ability to shapeshift, and they can appear as humans or other creatures, and some of them are Dharma practitioners. And some of them can be very helpful, and some of them can be very harmful. In any case, the Naga king appeared in the dream to Sakya Pandita's mother and asked permission to, what's the word, conceive in her. In the dream, she agreed. And when she woke up, she had this incredible bliss and clarity that never went away. So she had this really blissful pregnancy and gave birth to Sakyapandita. And when he was a little infant crawling, he wasn't speaking yet, he was crawling around in the dirt, his mother noticed that he was kind of writing in the dirt, kind of scribbling in the dirt. And then she noticed that if anybody came near, he would erase it immediately. And she thought, okay, this is interesting. But she wasn't quite sure what to make of it. But she noticed it. Then as he got a little bit older and he started to be able to speak, of course, we're in Tibet now, right? Mm-hmm. So he started speaking this strange language that she didn't know what it was, and she wasn't even sure that he was speaking a language. She thought maybe he had a speech defect. Mm-hmm. And she got really worried about her baby, who was just starting to speak. So she called his uncle, Drapa Gyaltsen, and said, "Uncle, please come and check this out. I'm a little bit worried about your nephew here." And so he did. He came and he listened to the baby talk. And he said, "Oh, that's Sanskrit. Don't worry about it. It's fine." Of course, she was relieved. But then he looked at the dust where the little baby was writing Sanskrit, and he noticed that not only was he writing Sanskrit, but he's writing in two different kinds of script. So there's the Lanza script, which, if you've ever seen a prayer wheel, the prayer wheels, the mantras are written in Lanza. And almost nobody, even today, can read it. And then the other script was called Nagari. Of course, Drapa Gyaltsen, being Manjushri, he could see that, and so he reassured Sakyapandita's mother. By the way, her name was Nyitri Cham. He said, "Yeah, it's fine, don't worry. And so everything was okay. Now, later, and so he was brilliant, he could memorize easily, he could understand everything, you know, he was taught, I think mainly by Drapa Gyaltsen. And he started teaching at the age of 12. And he wasn't just teaching any old topic, he was teaching Vajrayana. He was teaching the Samputta Tantra and the Vajrapanjara Tantra at age 12. Until he passed away at age 70, he taught every single day. That was one of his commitments that he made as a teacher, that he would teach every day. And sometimes that was problematic because he'd be doing other things during the day, like doing empowerments or translating or something, and then...
Traveling,
and then the evening would come and he hadn't taught, so then he would teach a class in the evening, and there were some times when he was awake 24 hours, because he made this commitment to be a teacher. Without interruption. As he was growing up, Drapa Gyaltsen was his guru, but he was also his uncle. And there's a story about that relationship, which is quite famous.
So you were saying Sakyapandita was the first...
Pandita. In Tibet.
Which is a title.
Yeah. They were in India previously, but he was the first one in Tibet.
Oh, in Tibet. Okay.
You have to show mastery of these 10 sciences. Oh. 5 major and 5 minor. So because Drapa Gyaltsen was the guru of Sakyapandita, they had a special relationship, obviously, besides the fact that they had a blood relationship. Sakyapandita did actually write an autobiography, and there's a quotation in this book from that autobiography in which he describes the situation of their relationship. And I'll read it now. And it says, this is regarding guru yoga. "As for myself, when I was young, I requested the great Jetson, Drapa Gyaltsen, to bestow the guru yoga blessing. But he did not approve. He said, 'You do not have the perception that I am a Buddha. Your perception is that I'm merely your uncle. Also, you are unable to perform hardship for your lama through the offerings of your body and your wealth. So he rebuked Sakya Pandita and said, no, I'm not going to give it to you. You don't have the right kind of attitude and vision towards me. You just think I'm, you know, uncle drop account. So then Sakya Pandita continues and says, terrifying signs of my death later occurred, accompanied by physical discomfort. But at the same time, Jetsun Drapa Galtsen also manifested discomfort for several days, during which time I continually offered service day and night without break and without any thought of sleep or food to him. This appears to have helped me purify some sins. Drapa Galtsen then bestowed the Guru Yoga blessing upon me, which produced in me the perception that my guru truly was a Buddha. I saw him as the real Manjushri, the embodiment of all the Buddhas, and genuine, uncommon devotion to him arose in me. This liberated me from my signs of death, and I became physically comfortable again. Then I was able to understand the unmistaken essential points of scripture and logical reasoning, such as Mantrayana, Paramitrayana, Abhidharma, Vinaya, Sanskrit, logic, poetry, prosody, synonyms, and others. I also attained great fearless courage regarding the entire Tripitaka, that's the three baskets of teaching, the Tripitaka. Humans, celestial beings, and demons showed great kindness to me, and even conceited Indian kings came to request me to bestow Dharma teachings. Some genuine realization also arose in my mind. So that's the end of the autobiography quotation. But then the biography says, another source demonstrates that the great Lama had been the spiritual master of great beings in previous lives. The great Lama is Drapa Galtsen. And furthermore, he was Sakya Pandita's teacher for many previous lives. It's said that one time when the Dharma teachings were being given in Sakya Monastery, a sound was heard in space saying, you have been a great Pandita, well trained in the commentary on valid cognition for 27 successive lives, and Drapa Galtsen was your spiritual master in each of those lives. Wow. No other master than him was able to tame you. And then another time, a similar occurrence spoke of 37 lives. And then another time, there was a Dharma teaching in Sakya, a sound was heard in the sky saying, Drapa Galtsen was your spiritual master for an inconceivable number of previous lives. And then he says, when I heard that sound, I was reminded of my previous lives. Sakya Pandita remembered his lives when he heard that sound. That's how Sakya Pandita came to see Drapa Galtsen as his guru and not just his uncle, and therefore could practice Guru Yoga. Sakya Pandita had three types of scholarly activities that he engaged in: teaching, composition, and debate. I said before that with teaching, he made a commitment to teach every day, and he was always being invited places to teach because, of course, he was instantly famous. I mean, he started teaching when he was a little kid, so he was always being invited. And he always said yes. And he always went and taught all over the place according to the needs of the listeners. Because he was a Buddha, he was clairvoyant. He knew what they needed, and he always taught to their needs. In that regard of being a scholarly activity of teaching, he taught what's called, the text called Clarifying the Sage's Intent, which we studied here not too long ago. It's a very famous book. It, for me personally, changed my life. In this particular book, it's translated as the illumination of sage's intent, but it's the same text, okay? When Sakyapandita was going around and teaching in various places, it says here, and I'll quote the biography, it says if Sakyapandita remained in a particular place for a few days extra, he would give a complete teaching of the illumination of sage's intent in order that the bodhisattva vow would not decline but would rather increase to greater heights. And for this reason, at the end of that great text, he stated, because I have taught this teaching in central Tibet, in Sang, in Kham, all of my disciples have received its transmission. I have advised them to study it and explain its meaning to others. In this way, he bestowed the precious teaching, and he even gave advice on how to skillfully accomplish worldly activities for the benefit of other beings. In regard to this quotation about Sakyapandita saying, well, I've given this all over the place, and I've advised my disciples to study it and explain its meaning to others, Lama Jampa was told by the 42nd Sakyatrizin to teach this text, and Lama Jampa said, well, I can't, I don't have the transmission. And Sakyatrizin told him, he said, no, don't worry about it. Sakyapandita gave an exemption. Anybody can teach this text. So Lama Jampa turned around and said to me, you teach it. Well, I spent the next year and a half studying like crazy, even though I had studied the text previously, because it was the text for the first year of the 7-year complete path program. So I had already been exposed to the text, and Lama Jampa said, well, you've been exposed to the text, you teach it. Okay. Anyway, you all can teach the text too if you want to. That was part of his scholarly activity of teaching. And then a third type of scholarly activity under teaching was establishing lineages of oral transmission. So we hear this all the time, oh, this oral transmission, this lineage, and so on and so forth. But he actually started some. And I'll just read from the biography that says, Sakyapandita established lineages of oral transmission of teaching of the great treatises of commentary on valid cognition, treasury of logic on valid cognition, and the treasury of Amidharma, and 3 Hevajra Tantras. And although they are not commonly classified as great treatises, among the still widely held teaching lineages that originated from Sakyapandita are the Vajra verses, the illumination of the sage's intent, and the jewel treasury of elegant sayings, which is a very commonly read book because it's easy to read and fun. So he established those. And it says that undoubtedly, though, some of the oral lineages that he started have been broken, such as the texts, the Compendium of Abhidharma, the Chakrasavara Tantra, the Guhyasamaja Tantra, and many other commentaries on those. He started those lineages, but they have not survived to the present day. The previous ones, I guess, have. So, in addition to the oral explanation lineages that came from Sakyapandita and have continued to be taught without interruption through the centuries to the present and are still widely held are his teachings on the Pratimoksha vows, generating wishing and entering bodhicitta, initiations that are methods of maturation of the 4 classes of tantra, various blessings, empowerments, and reading transmissions. All of those lineages still exist today that he started. So those are some of the activities, scholarly activities in regard to teaching. The second category is composition. What did he write? Well, a lot. 200 books. And honestly, it's pages and pages of titles in here. And so I'll just read the categories of the books that he wrote about. Sure. About his writings, it said that
there was a great variety, but there was also great quality. In terms of the variety, these are the categories, not the titles, okay? He wrote Elegant Sayings, we've already talked about that. He wrote books on linguistics. Some of these are the Pandita sciences that he had to master. He wrote books on linguistics. He wrote books on logic. He wrote books on art. He only wrote one book on medicine, but I'll tell you the title and then you realize why he only wrote one. Now when we say he mastered medicine, that meant that in terms of that period of time, from the medical systems that came from India and Tibet and China and all these places, he mastered all of them. And he was a practicing doctor in his spare time. And the medical book that he wrote was entitled Summary of the Eight Branches of Medical Treatment. Wow. So he just wrote a summary of them all. So that was just one book that he wrote on medicine. He also wrote books on one of the major sciences. It's called inner science. That means Dharma. And there's a long, long list of Dharma books that he wrote. I won't read them all. Different tantras and classifications and Prajnaparamita and, you know, on and on. Mantrayana. And then it's also listed here the categories of the minor sciences. Prosody, which is the study of the meter of poetry. That's a separate topic from poetry itself. Those are two separate topics. He studied both of those and wrote books on them. He wrote a book on synonyms. He wrote a book on drama. He wrote a book on music. And he explained the music and the songs of all the performances that are done, ceremonies and drupshans and lama dancing. A lot of them have music and dances, and it's all very elaborate. They go on for days and days and days, you know. In fact, to be qualified to apply to be one of the Sakya Trizins, there's a list of requirements you have to do besides being born in the Kun family. You have to pass a number of requirements, and one of them is you have to lead the Vajrakilaya Drupshan, which lasts 8 days, and you have to lead it from memory. And if you make a mistake, you can ask for help, but you get deducted 5 points. But you have to pass that. That's one of a number of serious requirements that you have to pass. And there are dungses, which is a word for prince. They are Sakya Trizins in waiting, so to speak, from the family. There's a number of them that are younger.
Yeah.
If you pass the requirements, it goes by age for a 3-year term. Okay, so anyway, he wrote books about all that, and he also wrote a lot of letters, because he was famous. He was also famous in India, too, by the way. And so people would write him letters, you know, masters would write him letters, you know, saying, could you clarify this, or what about that? They didn't have internet, they didn't have email, they didn't have, you know. So there are a lot of his letters that have survived on all kinds of topics, scripture, logic, pith instructions, other topics, questions from various masters, including Kadampa masters and great meditators and translators, and to each of whom he wrote homage prayers. Nice guy. And he wrote many, many other short works. Praises and so on, they're not listed here. But he was prolific, you know. So that's the variety of what he wrote. Now there's a section about the quality of what he wrote. Mm-hmm. All of Sakya Pandita's writing is said to have been composed spontaneously and with little effort. Vast meaning is demonstrated in his works by just a few words, and the meaning is clear and easy to understand, even by those who are not learned. Sakya Pandita's words are like elegant ornaments that greatly delight the learned, with meaning so extremely profound that the depths of his analysis cannot be plumbed even by the combined knowledge of hundreds of others who are said to be scholars. Concerning Sakyapandita's writing, Jogyapakpa wrote, "The swiftness of his composition is even faster than the movement of light, arising effortlessly as spontaneously as an ocean wave, and the weight of its magnificent meaning is praised by all the intelligent. The subtlety of its analysis is like that of none before. He illuminates minds like sunlight illuminates snowy mountain peaks and generates complete joy, like tasting the experience of the absorption in samadhi." Now, it's interesting that with one or two exceptions, he did not write commentaries on other masters' works.
Interesting.
And the reason he didn't, he said, there's plenty of commentaries written by other masters. Go study those. You don't need another one from me.
Right.
He intended that the writings of the previous Sakyalamas were none other than Vajradhara, who composed in detail, and he wanted them to not decline. So that's kind of an interesting little side note. There's another, because there's three biographies in this book, sometimes there's overlap, and I just want to see what Jogyapakpa wrote. Jogyapakpa said, or wrote, that regarding Sakyapandita's composition, it said that the text can be composed for two purposes, for the benefit of others, and to demonstrate elegant composition. When composed primarily to benefit others, the words and meaning of the texts are flawless, logical, and clear, in harmony with the sutras and tantras, beyond criticism, even by the most learned. Indeed, all of his writing is amazingly beautiful. Some of his works were composed primarily to demonstrate elegance in composition. For example, Elegant Sayings. All of these works are beautifully composed, the words and meaning are in balance, and the metaphors do not contradict the meaning behind them. Clear distinctions are made between the types of prose, heavy and light accents, long and short sounds. The words and punctuation beautify and ornament the composition. And although they are elegantly written, the meaning is clear, and the poetry is easy to recite and pleasant to hear. All of his writings are as works of pure gold, ornamented by jeweled tassels of precious stones such as rubies. It could be said that they are like a garland of perfect pearls, extremely beautiful and elegantly composed. And when his compositions are read or heard by others, they delight the learned, are suitable for quotation by the intelligent, and are the object of admiration by the wise. So that's a little praise, not little, a big praise of not only the variety, but the elegance of it. So that's the scholarly activity of composition. And the third scholarly activity that he engaged in was debate. Now that tanka shows Sakyapandita in the mudra of debate. You've maybe seen videos of the debaters, you know, where they have the malas and they do this. You know, well, that's that's him. There's a whole kind of explanation about why they do those mudras and so on and so forth. But that tanka captures the debate mudra. The statue, on the other hand, captures the teaching mudra. Okay. There's a very famous, famous debate story about Sakyapandita and his ability to debate, which I will now read you. And the title of this section, this is the the biography written by Jamnung Amitshab, and this subsection is entitled How Sakyapandita Crushed the Rocky Mountain of Inferior Views by the Power of the Thunderbolt of Debate.
Wow.
Awesome.
Just that.
And I would add, have a nice day. Yeah. It's pretty. Wow. Okay, so here's what he wrote. This is the biography. The fame of this master's great learning spread to every region of the land like the rays of the sun upon the earth. And in southern India roamed a Hindu logician known as Harinanda and a retinue of six other logicians who followed the sages of Kapila, Vyasa, and Kanada, who belonged to the Samkhya, Vedanta, and Nyaya schools. They believed in and worshipped the gods Ishvara, Brahmi, Lakshmi, King Vasava, and Agni. When they heard of Sakyapandita's fame, they declared, "We will travel to the land of snows, as we have heard that there is a monastic follower of Gautama who wears a woman's skirt. We want to convert him and reject his inferior views and conduct." Unquote. And with such proclamations, they arrived in Tibet. In response, the great master Sakyapandita and his retinue also traveled towards the holy shrine of Aryavati in the region of Kirong, where many people gather to barter merchandise. This is approximately 60 yojanas north of the Bodhi seat in Bodh Gaya, where Buddha attained enlightenment. Our Lord Lama, like a lion able to subjugate inferior opponents, also declared his willingness to enter debate. Now, I'll just interrupt with a little note of my own here. Kirong is right on the border of what's now Tibet and India. Of course, in those days, they didn't have the geographical maps that we have now. But it was kind of like halfway. But it was on the Tibet side of the mountains. And the holy shrine of Aryavati, well, I'll tell you about that afterwards, why that's there. Anyway, back to the story here. When the six logicians approached the Lord of Dharma, they uttered polite words of praise, but said, "It is not our tradition to prostrate to the shrine of the Sugata." And thus, they sat down upon their various seats. They proclaimed, "In our tradition, from the time of the Guru Brahma until the present, none of our masters have relied upon Gautama's doctrine, and we never take refuge in the Triple Gem. We are an extremely pure tradition of rishis." And thus the debate began. The Lord of Dharma, Sakyapandita, responded, "Are you oppressed by the sleep of great ignorance? Brahma himself was extremely devoted to the Buddha Shakyamuni." And then he quotes, Sakyapandita quotes, "Extremely exalted with four hands and faces looking in directions numbering half of 16, knower of concentrated recitations and authentic ritual, teacher of the Rig Veda, great Brahma was born from a flawless lotus yet fell asleep. Our guide, who possesses 10 powers, is always awake like early dawn." So that's a kind of a come back to the rishi saying, "Oh yeah? Okay." Engaging in such dialogue, they discussed extremely subtle arguments on numerous subjects for a long time. I believe later the text said 3 days. Okay. Sakyapandita was able to refute the opponent's every challenge word by word, rendering them speechless. Furthermore, he was able to influence them to give up their inferior views and to enter the flawless path. one of the agreements that they signed beforehand was whoever won, the other guy had to convert to the religion of the winner.
Wow. I think that was fairly standard. I've heard of that happening.
Yeah, but it was an agreement that they agreed upon. So he was able to influence them to give up their inferior views and to enter the flawless path. They took Buddhist vows, shaved their heavy loads of dreadlocks, and entered the path of renunciation, which contains the wealth of the precious jewels of the doctrine of Buddha Shakyamuni.
Does that imply that they became monks, not just Buddhists, but did they take monastic vows as well? Or maybe it doesn't say.
The leader did later. Uh-huh. I don't know about the followers.
Right, right. Oh, so it was just taking refuge, I suppose. Nowadays we often just clip a little bit of hair, right?
It depends on who's giving it,
right,
whether they do that or not. But it's common to have, like when I got my Nakpa vows, I got my hair clipped. And then Sakyapandita wrote a very sarcastic poem, which I will not read. A long poem, just chopping them to bits, basically.
In that book?
Yeah.
I was gonna ask you if you'd comment on that, because from reading the Sakya Lekshe, it seems to me like this. Maybe that's just me, but it seems like he's kind of stern. Would be the polite way of putting it, but otherwise, like, kind of cutting in his analysis. Like, it's so intellectually focused that I guess it would be really intimidating. So those guys would be freaked at a certain point.
Well, they were heavy hitters, and they challenged him because they wanted to take him down.
Yeah.
And he beat him, and he did a little bit of
and
got what was coming to you guys kind of poem.
He debated him in Sanskrit.
Huh? Yeah, this is all in Sanskrit.
He did it in Sanskrit.
It's all in Sanskrit.
So those people,
yeah, they didn't speak Tibetan, but that's no problem for him. You know.
They were from India.
They were from South India.
South India.
Yeah.
So they were debating in Sanskrit, and he was debating in Sanskrit, which is something else.
The final sentence after the poem says, "Their dreadlocks can still be seen in Sakya in the temple of Samye."
Oh,
and
he got a coup.
In the history of Tibetan Buddhism, only Sakya Pandita was able to defeat heretical Panditas through his knowledge of the Dharma.
Yeah.
Now, Samye, you may or may not be familiar with. They call it a monastery, but it's actually a big, big complex with a wall around it with many, many buildings. And it was actually the first Dharma monastery, but it's more than a monastery. It's a college and, meditation temples and all kinds of things, but it was the first one. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that more later. The dreadlocks were hung in Samye, and Lama Jampa told me when he was young, see, he was born in India, but he went to Sakya when he was 20 or something like that, and then did some time doing pilgrimage. And he said that the dreadlocks are hanging high, and when one of the masters gets stuck in a text, you have to understand too, these people from India, they were scholars, they were highly respected scholars, I mean, they were really knowledgeable, and the dreadlocks were considered holy, and when the Buddhist masters get stuck on a point somewhere, like a philosophical point or something, they would reach up and take one of the strands of hair out of the dreadlocks. And at that point, they would understand the text.
Mm.
Lama Jampa told me that.
Wow.
So,
power of the dreadlock. Interesting.
This is his teaching story, so to speak, and debate story. But there's a whole other story, a whole other section of his life when he went to Mongolia with his nephew, Chogyapakpa.
Sakya Pandita's nephew.
Yeah. Sonam Gyaltsen was Sakyapandita's brother, who was the father of Chogyapakpa. I didn't write that because it gets too crazy with names and things. But so when Chogyapakpa was 12 years old, Sakyapandita went to Mongolia and took him with him.
Wow.
Because he was the guru of Chogyapakpa.
Okay.
And there are many, many stories about all the things that happened there, and a lot happened there. So that's an upcoming section. And also there's the section on his passing away. So because this is a two-part teaching, we're going to be coming back next Thursday.
All right.
And next Thursday we will tell you the story about what happened in Mongolia. And also what happened when Jogyapakpa came back to Tibet. Because that was major historical importance. Major, major, major. And then we'll tell you about Sagavandita's passing, which was also quite a event. I'm going to add one little thing about the 10 sciences. One of them is art. The Samye Monastery, where the dreadlocks are, was one of the places where Sakya Pandita taught. Samye is not that far from Sakya. So he used to get invited there, and even to this very day, the Samye complex is managed by the Sakya Lamas, and the abbot is a Sakya Lama. So there's a connection with Samye and Sakya. So the Sakya Pandita was teaching there one day, and he had a clairvoyant intuition of some sort that there's going to be a really big fire is going to burn down Samye. Mm-hmm. So to stop that, to protect Samye, he made a drawing over the doorway of Samye, which is a very famous drawing. And Lama did a class on this drawing, and all the objects in this drawing, the birds and the swords and all this stuff, it all is symbolic. Wow. It has to do with translators. The birds are translators. The sword is Manjushri, and so on and so forth. It has not only symbolic meaning, but it stopped the fire. The fire never happened. And over the years, because we're looking at, 800 years here, some Sakya Lamas have not edited, but they've changed the drawing a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is the cover of our Chenrezig
right.
puja we do on Wednesday night, right?
Right.
But Lama told me this is one of the revised versions, which is technically incorrect because it has a dorji in it, which is Vajrayana. The original doesn't have that. You will see one of these images on books. That's the symbol of Manjushri at Samye. And as I said, next time we'll go into these other stories. The Sakya Lekshe book, which Linda taught about half of it and then took a break because it's a big, thick book. And then we started with the Lojong series and now this. And at some point, the rest of that book will be covered. But that's another book that you see that he wrote, which is advice for lay people. It's full of, you call them aphorisms, sayings. Before we do the dedication, are there any comments or questions people want to make?
I was wondering, I mean, I'm in a lot of ways I'm very new to Sakya. I was wondering, is the hat that he's shown wearing here, is that a very elaborate version of a pandit's hat, or is this a special sort of...
Let me look at it.
Yeah, because I was sort of wondering about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I realize I keep asking questions that are sort of weird questions.
No, they're not weird at all.
Yeah.
In my laptop, I have a file that shows about 15 or 20 different styles of Sakya hats.
Yeah.
And they all have, I don't know all of them, but this hat is the Pandita hat. And if you'll notice, you see on the side, there's these little things that come down.
Oh, the lappets or whatever they're called, yeah.
Right.
And then
right.
if you look at the present-day Sakya
Tucha. Oh, my goodness, is that what they are? They're
those
puppets.
Are the things that are flapped back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why?
Oh,
because
wow.
they're going to teach.
Right, right.
They're
oh,
active.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
I had never known that symbolism. That is amazing.
Oh, that's
yeah.
interesting.
And that's the hat that got taken off the statue. yeah. Any other comments or questions?
Good.
Okay. So if
it's
I can find...
Actually, it's wonderful that we have a second class because if we think of something,
yeah.
which is usually how I work, I'll think of something.
Yeah, yeah, bring your questions, yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
So now we're going to talk about the phase of Sakya Pandita's life when he goes to Mongolia with his nephew, Jogyapakpa. A little background about Mongolia. The Mongolia that we know today is nothing like the Mongolia of 1250. Basically, the Mongolian Empire covered most of Eurasia. The Mongolians had conquered China and all kinds of countries, east and west. The way they did that was with their fierce army, which was made up of horseback riding attackers. And what they would do is, before they would attack a country, they would go into the country and say, "We're going to offer you a peace deal, and what you have to do is you have to give us all your males for our army. You have to pay taxes to us, and you have to do what's called corvée, which is a kind of indentured servitude." In other words, people had to dedicate a year or two or even more of their work and the products of their work, for example, their crops, and it had to be given to the emperor of Mongolia, or the Khan. And those were the terms. If you did not accept the terms, the Mongol army would invade your country. They would kidnap all the males. They would kill many or most of the people. You would still have to pay the tax, and you would still have to do the corvée. So basically, you were going to have the same result either way. It's just whether you wanted to resist and have your country destroyed. And that's the technique that they used to conquer so much of the land and the surrounding countries. If you ever got a message from the Khan saying the Khan wants to see you, you immediately got on your horse the next morning and rode to Mongolia. You didn't wait, you didn't make any excuses. And in fact, that's what happened to Sakyapandita. Tibet at that time had not yet been conquered. However, when Sakyapandita was 62, he received a letter from Godan Khan, who was the grandson of Genghis Khan. And I'll now read you what the letter said from Godan Khan to Sakyapandita. Here's the letter. "Decree of I, the emperor, established by glorious foundation of great merit and the strength of the long life spirit of the sky, a message to inform Sakyapandita Kunga Gyaltsen Palsangbo. In order to repay the kindness of my father and mother and the earth and sky, my investigations reveal that I require a spiritual teacher who will be able to teach me the unmistaken path of what is to be adopted and abandoned. You are the designee. You must come here without thinking of the hardship of the journey. If you were to say that you were too old, wouldn't it contradict your commitment and understanding of the Dharma? How many times did the Buddha previously give his own body for the purpose of others? Whereas, if through martial law I send a great military force, this will cause terrible destruction to many sentient beings. Aren't you afraid of this? For these reasons, thinking of the Buddha's doctrine and thinking of protecting many sentient beings from harm, you must come swiftly. I will ensure you are respected by all the monastics of the Western Province. As tokens of my invitation, I send 5 large measures of silver, 1 Dharma robe made of brocade with tassels of 6,200 pearls, a long monastic overcoat of brocade, 1 fine pair of shoes, 2 fine pair of katak, 2 fine pair of tonti katak, and 20 bolts of 5 colored brocade. I send my emissary Dorsi Gon and my nephew Wonjo Dharma with these gifts. Written on the new moon of the 8th lunar month of the year of the dragon." And so thus the letter of invitation from Mongolia arrived in Sakya. And although the Lord of Dharma had reached an advanced age, he decided to embark disregarding his own life and motivated by the reasons explained above. So here you have the Godan Khan saying I want some Dharma instruction because I've been, I require a spiritual teacher. And if you don't come, I'll destroy your country. So it's clear that he needed a little bit more Dharma instruction. In any case, Sakya Pandita went to Mongolia with his 12-year-old nephew, Chogyal Pakpa. And in 1247, they arrived, and Sakya Pandita was 63 years old because he took some time to get there. He was giving teachings and empowerments on the way there. Remember, he was very famous and was constantly being requested to do various Dharma activities. So when Sakya Pandita arrived there and eventually met the Godan Khan, the Godan Khan had a skin disease, and as a result, in order to cure it, Sakya Pandita performed many rituals, including the Manjushri Torma water offering known as Chalto Jampala. And as a result of the rituals, he had a dream. Sakya Pandita had a dream, and in that dream, a person with a crippled leg appeared in the dream. And they were completely covered by rashes and sores of a skin disease. Sakya Pandita asked, "Well, who are you?" And the crippled person responded, "I have a leader who sent me to you saying, Lama Sakyapa is summoning me. See what he wants, for I can't go myself, so you must do so." Sakya Pandita responded, "The Emperor Godan sent his messenger and invited me from afar. I came here to help him. He has an illness. What is the cause of his illness, and what will be the cure of his disease?" The crippled one explained, "My leader owned this area before anyone else did. In one of Emperor Godan's previous lives, he was born as the king of this area and accumulated merit towards Buddha Shakyamuni. After passing from that life, he was born the king of Minyak, and there built a house on top of my leader's home. The king of Manyak invited Tibetan monks to perform rituals with musical instruments, chanting, and torma offerings to request use of the land. But they did not know how to properly perform the ritual to request the land, and as a result, my leader did not give permission. However, the king of Minyak began construction anyway, and their relationship with each other was unpleasant and waxed and waned. Eventually, due to the superior merit of the human race, my leader was unable to defeat the king, so he decided to move to this northern area and take up residence here. Again, the emperor came to this area and burned the land above our homes, dug up the earth, and harmed us greatly. And now we cannot find a place to stay. My leader was extremely angry at him. So gathering all the local spirits in this area, he said, 'This king expelled me twice. Now I shall take revenge. I request all of you spirits to join me in fighting this king.' The local spirits said, 'Because this king has accumulated merit towards Buddha Shakyamuni, we are unable to defeat him. Therefore, we recommend that you do not remain in this dry area. Take up residence where there are unowned springs, swamps, and wetlands.' My leader took their advice. Around that time, the king examined the records of previous kings and found that Buddhist monks had received too many stipends and reduced this amount going forward. Also, wishing to determine whether a statue of Buddha Shakyamuni was solid gold or made of wood or stone, the king dug into the bottom of it with a chisel. The local spirit said, 'Due to these non-virtuous actions, the king's merit will now decline, and so we will be able to cause obstacles for him.' Although they went against the king, they were unable to defeat him because he was still very powerful and had tremendous merit. However, the spirits caused some of the king's ministers to break away, revolt against him, and finally assassinate him. And just before he died, the king made the aspiration, 'In my next life, may I be born as the son of a king in this area. and be able to subdue all of you as my servants. And through the power of this aspiration, Godan Khan was born, grandson of Genghis Khan, and he came to this area. He disturbed all the swamps, wetlands, and springs in our territory with horse races, and he spread the blood and carcasses of dead horses everywhere. Due to this contamination, my body was injured, and the creatures in the water, such as small fish and frogs, have also been greatly weakened and are nearly dead. Due to the warmth of my leader's body, they have not yet died, but their bodies are shriveling up. Seeing this situation, some monks made aspirations and prayers, but none of those prayers helped our Naga leaders. But now the Lord Sakyapaya is giving medicine and food to us, which is greatly helping. I was previously unable to go anywhere, but now I am feeling a bit better and am able to travel a little. My leader is now close to death. If he dies, Godan Khan will also die. If my leader is cured, surely Godan will also be cured. A few small prayers will not be that effective. You must undertake a major effort to restore the health of both my leader and Godan Khan. If my leader is cured, Godan will also be cured. As a result, he will do well by you. And just as Sakyapandita thought, what would be the most benefit in this matter? The crippled one disappeared. To benefit the emperor, the Lord of Dharma performed the ritual of Bodhisattva Simanada. The emperor was completely cured of his skin disease and became extremely devoted to Sakyapandita. He also took the Bodhisattva vow, received many profound and vast Dharma teachings, and venerated Sakyapandita as an ornament upon his crown. Another story tells of how the Lord of Dharma and Emperor Godan had numerous dialogues and conversations, in the course of which it was asserted that the Sutra of Golden Light states that turtles do not have any hair. Following the discussion, the emperor disputed the statement, displaying to the Lord of Dharma a turtle's skin as wide as the height of a human, upon which was long hair and a multicolored design like a rainbow. Sakyapandita observed, "Oh, this could not be the regular skin of a common turtle. A sutra states that some bodhisattvas take birth in a turtle-like form in order to benefit beings that dwell in the sea. No doubt this is the skin of such a being. And as evidence, if the design is carefully examined and expertly interpreted, it will be seen that it's in the shape of 1,000 Buddhas surrounded by 8 Bodhisattvas." And with these words, he pointed out each and every part of the design, and all the gathering were amazed. But the emperor felt somewhat embarrassed and thought, "Well, I must make some response to this." So he summoned his ministers and asked them to invite magicians and have them create the appearance of an amazing temple with their occult powers. As he bade, they created such a temple more enticing than any ever seen before. The emperor himself came and said to Sakyapandita, "I invited you here as the object of veneration. You are skilled and learned, and I have seen that you have a multitude of amazing positive qualities. This brings me great delight. Now, there is an amazing temple in an isolated place. Come with me so that I may offer it to you." Having spoken thus, the great master with his disciples and the emperor and his retinue embarked for the temple. As soon as the Lord of Dharma saw the temple, he knew that it had been created by magicians. There were many fearsome gatekeepers and door guardians, and Sakyapandita blessed them and bade them to heed him. There were also many holy statues and images which he consecrated by strewing flowers. As a result, the magicians were unable to dissolve what they had created, and it became a real temple. It was named Emanation Temple and is said to still exist. we will talk about Sakyapandita's passing away, his parinirvana. Thus, until the age of 70, this great Lama, the second omniscient teacher to appear in this degenerate age, performed great service to the Buddha's teachings and established countless sentient beings in the stage of maturation and liberation. The biographer will now describe the manner of the withdrawal of the manifestation of the great biographer's form body at the conclusion of his holy life. And here we have the description of Jamyang Amishab, one of Sakyapandita's biographers. Jamyang Amishab was the 27th Sakyatrizin. And here's his writings. In the 9th month of the year, 1251, when the Master manifested his intent to depart for the benefit of beings elsewhere, it is said that 18 great signs occurred. On the 8th day of the 9th lunar month, a great trembling of the earth occurred, and I, the physician Biji, asked what this portended. Sakyapandita responded, "When great sons of victors intended to depart for the benefit of others, such signs occurred. It seems we are also following their footsteps." At midnight on the 29th day of the month, Sakyapandita told me that the Buddha King, proclaimer of inexhaustible melodious sounds, directly manifested in Sambhogakaya form with one face and two hands. Sakyapandita told me, "Light incense," and so I lit incense. As the night ended and the dawn broke, Sakyapandita again said, "The 11-faced Avalokiteshvara has directly come and blessed me. Light incense." On the 6th day of the 10th month of Mindruk, the sounds of myriad celestial instruments were heard. I was in Sakyapandita's presence and said, "Oh, there are many people in the shrine room. It seems they're performing the ritual of Ushnisha Vijaya." The Lord of Dharma said, "Go to the shrine room and see whether or not they're performing the ritual." And when I went to the shrine room, I realized that the people there had also heard the sounds of the instruments, and they said, "What could these sounds be? Ask the Lord of Dharma." When I asked him, he responded, "I received a welcome reception from celestial beings. Now I need to depart for my own and others' benefit." And on that same day, there was a shower of many snowflakes in the shape of flowers, which were visible in the air, but did not accumulate on the earth. On the 13th day of the month, while we sat in the remaining sunlight, a beautifully shaped long white cloud appeared. The Lord of Dharma smiled and, pointing his finger at the sky, said, "Did you see that?" I responded, "I can't see anything, but I feel very joyful." And he said, "It seems that you have fewer sins, but that you still have some stain-like sins, and so you should perform practices for eliminating them." I beheld Lord Buddha Shakyamuni seated upon a lion throne with a retinue of Shravakas. Sakyapandita asked me to light incense, so I lit incense. On the morning of the 14th day, while we were sitting in the sun, a similar cloud appeared. The Lord of Dharma told me, "I have clearly seen the mandala of Shirdi He Vajra, light incense." On the morning of the 15th day, while we were sitting outside, a similar cloud again appeared. He told me, "I have seen Manjushri thrice." He asked me to light incense, so I lit incense three times. Finally, the Lord of Dharma gazed at me and smiled. I asked him, "What is happening?" He told me, "Manjushri and Maitreya Bodhisattva are having a dialogue." He even told me what they were saying, but I have forgotten the words. Later, when we were circumambulating, the attendant Chogyam Pa was carrying a small throne in the shape of a table in one hand and holding a cushion on top of it. We proceeded along, and I held the Lord of Dharma's left hand. When we reached the shrine room, the Lord of Dharma sat upon the small throne, and he advised Chokin Pao go make tea for us. He then said to me, you go and light some incense. When I lit the incense and brought it to him, he said, Ayu Tara. It seems that he had perceived Tara. At midnight on the 17th day, I was standing in the presence of the Lord of Dharma, who was also standing. He asked me, don't you see anything? I heard the sounds of singing and musical instruments. There were many others with us, including Lopanjon, who also heard the sounds of the instruments, but did not perceive anything unusual about the sounds. Sakyapandita gazed upon me and said, I saw 13 different mandalas, the mandala of Shakasambhara, and also many male and female viras, all dancing and singing songs. He then quoted a number of the words of the songs, but I could not catch them. Lopanjon seems to have remembered some of the verses, but I did not write them down because, Sakyapandita said, do not tell others as it will cause them to accumulate negativity. Then Drapa Gyaltsen appeared to Sakyapandita and told him, when it's your time to depart this place for the benefit of other beings, you will become a Vidyadhara who dwells in space towards the east, beyond many worlds of existence. You will please a multitude of Tathagatas, completely purify the environment as a Buddha realm, and bring about the maturation of many yet unmatured beings. On the seventh day of the 11th month, the sound of celestial musical instruments clearly resounded. Everyone who gathered at the emanation temple clearly heard this. I asked Sakyapandita, what does this signify? And he responded, all of you should diligently perform prayers. According to the sutras, a single moment of service to the guru, from whom you have received empowerment, generates more merit than offering even your own body, including head, limbs, and other parts. One night, I attempted to support the Lord of Dharma the entire night from dusk until dawn, sometimes from his back and sometimes from the side of his body. He told me, ask Dula Gyaltsen to come here. When he arrived, the Lord of Dharma said, bring me the chamse, the heavy monastic robe that was offered by Lady Sorotka. When it was brought, he told me, use this. You and I have many connections from previous lives, too. In this life, at first you were my tea server. Then I sent you to Jobom Gyokshi in Minyak Garu. Later, despite the invasion by the armies, you didn't die, but came here, and now you serve me. In the next life, it's inevitable that you will take birth in my presence. Early in the morning of the 14th day of the 11th month, the Lord of Dharma peacefully departed. Many sounds of celestial instruments were heard. Victory banners were seen. A variety of offering melodies were heard, and the earth trembled. On the 25th day of the month, the cremation was performed. All of the smoke appeared in the form of rainbows, and everyone who gathered at the ceremony heard many sounds of musical instruments. All of the holy relics which remained were in the shape of round ringsol, with the largest ones bearing images of deities. In such ways, inconceivable signs naturally occurred, which continued to act for the benefit of beings. Sakyapandita had a lot of dreams, and the biography written by Chogyapakpa is interesting, because Chogyapakpa was there. He was Sakyapandita's nephew and presumably heard a lot of things that no one else heard. So here are a couple of dreams that Chogyapakpa wrote down, which Sakyapandita had. One night, when he was 18 years old, Sakyapandita dreamed that he received teachings on the treasury of Abhidharma directly from Vasubandhu, in front of Achistupa behind Sakya Monastery. He experienced that night as an entire month. In front of the stupa, his master Vasubandhu faced east. The master's complexion was slightly blue, and he was not too young of middle age in his dream. In his dream, Sakyapandita received the complete Abhidharma teachings over a single 30-day period, each morning for 30 mornings. The Lord of Dharma sat to the right of Master Vasubandhu, facing the north, and reading the text while receiving the teachings. When he awoke early the next morning, Sakyapandita had the entire treasury of Abhidharma in his memory, both the words and the meaning. And he said later, when he actually received the teachings of the treasury of Abhidharma from the Kashmiri Pandita Shakya Shiribhadra, it was identical. Another time, Sakyapandita dreamed of someone who said, "I want to give you the throne of Master Dignaga. Please follow me." He then led Sakyapandita to a cave in India that faced east and said, "This is Master Dignaga's cave." When the door of the cave opened, the master saw that one side of the cave was filled with texts. He opened the texts and read them. And while he was reading, someone came and pulled the hem of his Dharma robe. And he awoke while he had not yet had enough time to read all the texts. My Lord said that this might have been an indication that in those days he had many distractions, and he had to give teachings to people from far away, which somewhat interrupted his genuine study of the Dharma. He also said that after this dream, special wisdom arose in him, through which he could unmistakably understand the meaning of the logic texts. Remember, Sakyapandita started teaching when he was 12 years old, and he made a vow that he would teach every day. And he did, every day until he was 70. Sakyapandita told Jogyepakpa the following: "One night I dreamed I was seated upon a high throne made of stone, giving Dharma teachings to an ocean-like gathering. I began speaking in Sanskrit with the first verses of the commentary on valid cognition, which were, 'Prostrations to you who have thrown off the net of conceptual thought and possess a profound and vast body from which shine ever noble rays of light in all directions.'" Sakyapandita continued, "At that moment the sun and the moon arose from my right and left shoulders. The next morning I related the dream to my Lord of Dharma, Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen, and he replied, 'This is a rarely occurring dream. We must celebrate it fully by making offerings.'" Sakyapandita told Jogyepakpa of another dream, in which he said, "A creek to the west of Sakya had become a huge river. On the bank of the river, my Lord of Dharma Jetsun Rinpoche Drapa Gyaltsen sat where the bank steps down to the water, listening to the secret songs of the Mantrayana Dharma sung by Lopan Sonam Semo, who held his head high. While I listened, I climbed the steps of the bank towards Sonam Semo. I heard that a similar dream had occurred to Shakya Shiribhadra, and when I asked him about it later, the dream had occurred to both of us on the same night." When the Lord of Dharma was residing in Sinpuri, early in the morning he dreamed that some lay people appeared. They made prostrations and offerings to him, saying, "Don't all sentient beings experience the suffering of the four torments of birth, illness, old age, and death?" He replied, "Yes, they do." And they said, "We would like to request from you a prayer that they may be freed from these." Sakyapandita said, "Despite understanding birth as birthless, I am still not freed from the cage of birth. In every birth, in whatever birth I take birth, protect me from birth in an inferior birth." And thus he spoke. And then the people asked, "In that case, is it permissible to replace illness, aging, and death with birth in this prayer?" And Sakyapandita responded, "Yes, it's permissible." And so the people replied, "Glorious Lama, Lord of Dharma, omniscient teacher, Lama, through your kindness accept us. In this birth and in every existence, protect us from the suffering of birth, illness, age, and death." And with these words, they offered prostrations and thanked him. And when he awoke from the dream, Sakyapandita thought, "Oh, these were the kings of the Dharma protectors of that shrine." Another account describes how one night the great master dreamed he was traveling on a mountain where there was a cave. So those are some of the dreams that were written down in the biographies that Sakya Pandita had. That concludes the actual biography of Sakya Pandita. It's important to know that his influence continued on through his nephew Jugyapakpa, who ended up carrying on the tradition of being guru to the Khans of Mongolia. And as a result of that, the subsequent Khan basically gave Tibet to Jugyapakpa to rule over, not only in the spiritual sense, but in the temporal sense. And so for about 150 years, the Sakyas ruled Tibet, and as a result of that, the Sakya teachings spread far and wide throughout Tibet. And of course, they were already in Mongolia. And even to this day, Mongolia is Sakya, is Sakya influence, because of this historical connection going back to Sakya Pandita in 1250. The five founders of the Sakya school have done incredible things, and that tradition of the Sakya school is still alive today. And most of the teachings that we receive in our center are direct Sakya lineage teachings. So now we can do the dedication of merit.
By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow to flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues, that I might train to be like them. To this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate the roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you very, very much.